Hello there. Today is Tuesday, November 21st. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the U.S. puts North Korea back on the list of state sponsors of terrorism.
This just continues to tighten the pressure on the Kim regime, all with an intention to have him understand this is only going to get worse.
The Trump administration sues a major telecom company to stop a big merger. More prominent U.S. newsmen are accused of sexual improprieties. Also ahead, an actress turns her recovery from addiction into a powerful documentary. It's all on today's International Edition. The U.S. is returning North Korea to a list of states sponsoring terrorism after a 10-year absence, a move that will put additional financial and diplomatic pressure on the Pyongyang government. President Trump Monday called North Korea a murderous regime and said this should have happened a long time ago.
It should have happened years ago. In addition to threatening the world by nuclear devastation, North Korea has repeatedly supported acts of international terrorism, including assassinations on foreign soil. As we take this action today, our thoughts turn to Otto Warmbier, wonderful young man, and the countless others so brutally affected by the North Korean oppression.
Secretary of State Rex Tillerson told White House reporters in a follow-up briefing Monday that this continues to put pressure on North Korea.
It is very symbolic on the one hand because it just points out again what a rogue regime this is and how brutal this regime is and how little they care for the value of human life. So I think that in of itself makes a strong statement of just the nature of this regime. And as I've said, the practical effects may be limited, but we're closing off a few loopholes with this.
Tillerson noted recent success in persuading other countries in the region to withdraw support from the regime. The U.S. first put North Korea on the terror sponsor list in 1988 after North Korean agents blew up a South Korean civilian airliner, killing 115 people. But it was removed in 2008 after Pyongyang met benchmarks related to a nuclear disarmament deal. Well, those talks collapsed a short time later, and North Korea declared the nuclear deal void. It has since conducted 5 more nuclear tests and steadily ramped up its ballistic missile program in violation of UN Security Council resolutions. Tufts University Korea expert Sung Yoon Lee tells VOA's Victor Beatty he agrees with the latest actions.
There's been a very strong movement within Congress to get the administration to relist North Korea as a state sponsor of terrorism. You know, Trump's announcement during this week of a major holiday in the United States with Thanksgiving Day just looming, it gives North Korea the excuse to conduct another major weapons test and then to deflect blame onto the United States to do something North Korea would have done anyway and lay the blame on the U.S. North Korea will say this is a provocation, it's unacceptable, and call Trump a host of unkind names, as it has in recent days, calling Trump a vermin, bacteria, a cockroach, and so forth. But the question is, does this act have beyond symbolic opprobrium? Does it have real practical financial costs? And I would say decidedly yes.
So there is an upside to this argument?
Yes, there is. First of all, North Korea never should have been taken off the list when it was during the Bush administration in 2008. That removal of North Korea from the list was in return for Pyongyang's illusory promise of denuclearization and full compliance with inspections requirements. We know none of that has come into fruition. What are the practical benefits of relisting North Korea? From now, any bank that seeks to process dollar transactions using U.S. dollar denominations on behalf of a North Korean entity is now required to apply for a Treasury Department license, a permit, if you will. It adds an added layer of deterrence, whereas before the relisting, a bank that may be suspicious that this is a shady deal with North Korea will most likely blithely just go on and do it, ignore it, and will probably be able to fly under the radar. Now, if a bank is found to have willfully violated U.S. laws, then conceivably, the United States will at some point levy a major fine on that bank on the scale of BNP Paribas, the biggest French bank, which was fined almost $9 billion for violating this kind of general licensing requirements with respect to Iran, Sudan, and Cuba. So, you know, it's not merely symbolic. It has real financial costs on North Korea's business partners.
You seem to agree with Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, who said the designation would help dissuade third parties from supporting Pyongyang since North Korea is already heavily sanctioned.
That's right. And, you know, African states, and there are a few in Africa and also states in the Middle East that continue to import small arms like rifles and grenades from North Korea, as well as, you know, military equipment like gas masks and military training, etc. All these nations that go on importing North Korean arms now would be ineligible for receiving U.S. foreign aid. So that is a powerful deterrent to these small countries with questionable, not very high functioning economies. Now the choice is stark: do business with North Korea or forgo U.S. foreign aid. So that is a strong deterrent. Also, now that North Korea is back on the list, its state immunity from a domestic U.S. legal perspective is now stripped. And that allows U.S. victims of North Korean terrorism, for example, families of Otto Warmbier or the family of the Reverend Kim Dong-sik, who was a resident in Chicago, who was abducted, tortured, and killed in North Korea. These families could sue North Korea, and there would be legal precedents, judgments, you know, ordering the North Korean government to pay tens of millions or perhaps hundreds of millions of dollars to these victims.
Other countries, by the way, on the terrorism sponsors list are Iran, Sudan, and Syria. Here are some of the other stories we're following at voanews.com. Robert Mugabe heads for impeachment after ignoring the resignation deadline. The U.S. could soon resume visa consultations at consulates in Russia. Amsterdam and Paris have been picked to host EU agencies after Brexit. And the U.S. state of Nebraska okays the Keystone Oil Pipeline route. Find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at voanews.com. And on our VOA mobile app, this is International Edition. CBS has suspended its morning show host, Charlie Rose, while PBS has halted his interview show after eight women accused the veteran newsman of inappropriate behavior. The Washington Post said the women reported Rose groped them and walked naked in front of them. Rose told the Post that he was deeply embarrassed and apologized for his behavior. Also on Monday, White House reporter Glenn Thrush with the New York Times was suspended for allegations of sexual misconduct. They're just the latest public figures accused of sexual improprieties. Stories like these have been coming in a flood since the New York Times first reported on Hollywood mogul Harvey Weinstein's behavior in early October. Joining me now to discuss this is Mike Domish, founder and CEO of the Date Safe Project. Mike, it seems like we're seeing new accusations every day. What's going on here?
What's happening here is that when survivors come forward and they feel that they can be supported, other survivors hear a survivor being supported, see a survivor being supported, and the fear of, I didn't want to come forward all these years, which can be one of the reasons, is that maybe people won't believe me, maybe I won't be fully supported. That fear can dissipate greatly when you see survivors being supported. And so you can suddenly realize, wait, maybe I can speak out. Maybe I'm allowed to have justice. There's an opportunity here to have justice. And some can even think maybe allowed, because they thought before, I'm never getting my chance to speak my mind of what was done. And now there's this opportunity to do that. And there's this avenue for me able to do that. And so people feel safer coming forward.
you know, there are people that are out there saying, will all the men who haven't done something inappropriate step forward? Is this just part of our culture that needs, that is finally sort of facing a stark reality?
That is the part of the conversation we need to be having as a country and as a culture as a whole. And that is how much sexual inappropriateness is ingrained in our culture. And if we all look in the mirror and are honest with ourselves and say, how often have I? Or when did I? You know, whether it was in middle school, high school, college, or a team you were on, or a sports team, or as an adult now, have I ever crossed that line? Is it possible that I was saying something that I thought was innocent and it wasn't? It could have done harm to someone else. And being able to look ourselves in the mirror and go, how have I contributed to this atmosphere? We all have to have that honest conversation with ourselves. Now, with that said, if you're answering, well, yeah, I could have, geez, I've said something that could be considered sexually inappropriate and maybe somebody could have been uncomfortable about it. But Mike, are you comparing that to somebody committing sexual violence or an act of sexual assault? And there's where the difference is, right? There is a difference in being sexually inappropriate amongst friends, peers, teammates, and sexual harassment, which creates a workplace environment situation or a power role situation. So there's difference there. There's also a difference in sexual assault, which is actual sexual contact without consent.
We're hearing of sexual harassment and we're hearing of potential sexual assault. Is it fair to differentiate? People are saying, well, Al Franken should resign, and yet Roy Moore, who's accused of allegedly molesting minors, as opposed to Al Franken, it would sound more like harassment. Is it fair to differentiate, or is it all on an equal platform of inappropriate?
Well, that's the danger. The danger is to try to say what's worse, because if you're the survivor, that we don't have the right to say what was worse when it's the survivor who went through it, right? And so people say all the time, well, this form of sexual violence is worse than that form of sexual violence. It depends on the survivors, what the impact to them was, how they feel about that. They may very much different with you if we had the two survivors sitting here that experienced different situations. So that's really a dangerous line to walk along. What's more important to discuss is what happened. Was it wrong? Should that person resign or should they be terminated from their role? And in many of these cases, the answer is yes, 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 yes. Regardless of whether one is worse than the other, the question is, was harm done and should someone be held accountable? That's what we should be focusing on, because it's way too subjective to say what form of sexual violence is worse than another. It's appalling when we see people saying, even if a certain person is a child predator, I'm going to vote for this person. Imagine what you are saying to the millions of survivors in this country and around the world. That is a horrific message. And that's why I say we have to be strong across all political parties on this discussion.
That's Mike Domish, founder and CEO of the Date Safe Project. Thanks for being with us. The Justice Department is suing AT&T to stop its $85 billion purchase of Time Warner. The telecom giant's CEO, Randall Stephenson, said earlier this month that he would not sell key franchises of Time Warner just to get the deal done. Joining us now to understand what's happening here is Washington-based antitrust law attorney Jonathan Rubin. So does this potentially set the stage for an epic legal battle between the government and AT&T?
Well, I think that AT&T is going to have to evaluate its options, and they will look at the case closely, and they sound like they're going to go in for a fight, but it's not over till it's over, and is a pretty compelling theory on the side of the government, and they may decide to throw in the towel, which is normally what happens when the Justice Department challenges a deal.
What exactly is their challenge? Why do they have a problem with this merger?
Well, the antitrust laws have a very sort of common sense provision that says that if two companies merge and that merger results in substantially lessening competition in a given market, then the merger is unlawful. And in this case, what they're concerned about is the acquisition of the programming assets of Time Warner by one of the major distributors of programming, AT&T and DirecTV, will substantially decrease competition because it will give so much bargaining power to the AT&T Time Warner combined company. The threat that they might withhold HBO or the Turner channels, CNN, from rival programming distributors is what is the concern of the complaint in the Justice Department and the reason why they're saying that competition would be lessened if the deal went through.
So now that you mentioned CNN, could CNN be an argument from AT&T that the president has stated on more than one occasion his animosity toward that network? And could that hinder the government's case?
I mean, it might be an argument. That's something that the AT&T folks and their publicity department are going to have to look very closely at, because it's a kind of a double-edged sword. You're really impugning the reputation of the career lawyers that are working in the antitrust division on behalf of the American people and enforcing the antitrust laws. The tradition there is in antitrust generally, and I think the DOJ has been pretty good about this, to be apolitical and to call them as they see them. So if there's a competition problem, there's a competition problem. It's not expected that a political actor or the executive branch or someone in Congress could actually put, you know, any measurable weight on the scales. They may object, they may make noise, and, you know, statements may be made about this, that, or the other thing, but it's unlikely to affect the actual work of the DOJ. I know some of the people that are involved down there, and I know that they must bristle at the suggestion even that there's been some political interference, because they're very serious professionals and they take the antitrust law seriously. And, you know, even a president likes a deal or doesn't like a deal really has nothing to do with it.
All right. Washington-based antitrust law attorney Jonathan Rubin, thank you for your time. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, this is Victor Beatty, managing editor of VOA News. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts every hour on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
VOA's International Edition continues now with what's trending on social media. And for that, we're joined by VOA's Andrew Palchevsky. Hey, Andrew, what's the word today?
An update on a story that we had last week. As you might remember, there was an uproar on Twitter because Twitter verified a man who was associated with the Unite the Right rally. That was that rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, with white supremacists.
Right.
And Twitter verified him because they said he was a notable figure, regardless of what he was tweeting about and what positions he held politically. This did not sit well with Twitter users, and so Twitter rolled back their verification process. They put it on pause. Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey came out and said they were going to re-examine it, and now we have word that they have.
Okay.
In fact, they've re-examined it to the point where Twitter says they reserve the right to remove verification at any time without notice, and not just for things that you do on Twitter. Things like promoting hate and violence, targeting people on the basis of race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, age, any of those things will get you banned and blocked and have your verification taken away. Engaging on any of those things outside of the network as well that can be verified will also result in your verification being removed.
Okay.
They're taking this from beyond the social network into the broader world to try to get a better handle on who's getting verified and who isn't. The big issue, as I said here, was that this white supremacist was verified because he was a notable figure, and that was the standard that Twitter used previously. With this new policy, they've updated that. It's not just that you are a notable figure, but you're upholding your life, both on Twitter and in real life, to their code of standards.
All right. Anything else going on?
Yes, a big to-do about the selfie. Because it was on Monday that, of course, Paris Hilton, the famous socialite, tweeted out a picture of her and pop singer Britney Spears and said, 11 years ago, Britney Spears and I invented the selfie. The problem is that, as a lot of people pointed out, she did not, in fact, invent the selfie. There were a lot of people before her that took selfies. And with each successive social media post, we saw how it got earlier and earlier and earlier. So someone posted a picture of Madonna taking a selfie in the 1980s. That was followed up by a picture of George Harrison from the Beatles taking a selfie in front of the Taj Mahal in 1966. Goes all the way back to a tweet that people found from the National Gallery of Scotland. They tweeted this back in September, a photo of a man named Robert Cornelius from 1839, which they say is the first recorded selfie ever.
How?
That's what they claim. They said that it's the first instance that they have documented of someone turning the camera around and taking a picture of themselves rather than taking a picture of, say, scenery or family members or whatnot. And even the term selfie, which is a more recent term, was not invented by Paris Hilton, because as other social media users pointed out, that term was first used on the internet back in 2002. By an Australian man, because Australians like to create shortened words, put words together to shorten them. So he created the word selfie, and it has become quite a word since then and used by many people around the world. But to set the record straight, not invented by Paris Hilton.
All right. Thank you, Andrew. You can follow him on Twitter at APAL. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Drug addiction continues to be a growing problem in America, particularly the opioid epidemic. My next guest understands the problem firsthand. Marissa Vitali is a Los Angeles-based actress and movie producer who just made a short film called Grace about her own struggles and recovery from addiction. So thanks for being with us. You've got a lot of acting. You've done a lot of acting, but this one is definitely personal for you. What compelled you to make the film?
For me, writing was always a healing part of my journey through recovery. So I had always actually been writing my story, but I wasn't sure where it ended or how it ended. And unfortunately, I feel as a community, as a country, we're always focused on the problem. You can watch any movie, any TV show when it deals with addiction. I mean, anybody can watch a TV show and learn how to shoot a bag of dope, smoke a crack pipe. It always shows the active use of addiction. And so I really wanted to shift the conversation to move from talking about the problem of addiction to the solution, which is living in recovery. And that was really what I wanted to achieve with creating this film, is to start a conversation around recovery and really build a bridge between people who are living in recovery and those who are addicted, know someone who's addicted, or someone that's just struggling. I feel that as a community, if we can be more compassionate with one another and have a little bit more understanding, there will be able to be a lot of healing that can take place. Unfortunately, throwing money at problems doesn't necessarily solve them. It just kind of makes them go away for a moment.
So how did your addiction journey start and end?
Well, I grew up at a time when it was pre-anti-bullying campaigns, and I did experience a lot of bullying growing up as a child, and I never really felt like I knew what to do with that, where to go with that, all of those feelings of feeling less than, angry, hurt, confused, like, why is this even happening? And for me, I mean, by the time I got to junior high and high school and at a party and had my first drink, I was like, wow, you mean if I drink this, I don't have to feel all of that stuff? You know, when you throw some teenage hormones in the mix, you're pretty much ready to explode. So the fact that I made the association that I didn't necessarily have to feel those feelings was wonderful for me at the time. And then that just spurred the exploration into different drugs, how they would make me feel, and the idea and the need of wanting to escape.
A lot of people who end up addicted, they are clearly trying to self-medicate from some sort of pain. So at what point did you realize that you wanted to fix this?
As in everyone, we all have our own moment of clarity, so to speak, or spiritual awakening, as some may say. And, you know, for me, it got to a point where, and, you know, I had all the things on the outside, you know, had graduated NYU, good family, wonderful suburban upbringing, all of the accolades that you would check off on the list, that this is a good family, this is a woman who's a young lady actually at the time who's destined for success, so to speak. And I can say that at the end, I found myself homeless. not knowing where or how I was going to get money to be able to support my habit, and just really kind of burnt out on the living to use and using to live. Hmm. And in that moment, I realized that everything I had protected to try to keep this lifestyle a secret really didn't matter anymore. And I was just tired. I just didn't have it in me anymore. And, you know, as soon as I kind of had that realization, things moved very quickly. I ended up in a detox, was in a therapeutic community for 4 months, came out, did outpatient. And, you know, it was like as soon as I started doing the right things for the right reason, everything just moved very quickly. But it did take me a little while to get to that point.
The documentary, what do you hope people will take away from it?
I want people to take away the inspiration to talk about this, because there's such a stigma attached to addiction. And the more people become comfortable talking about it and shine light on this, the less people will feel like they have to keep it hidden if they are struggling. And so I really want people to walk away being inspired to have a conversation and to just talk about it. It should be a topic at dinner tables at night. I mean, I think what MTV did with teen pregnancy and safe sex back in the day was fantastic. They brought it to light and did a huge campaign around it. And I think it's the same concept around addiction. The more people talk about it and desire to talk about it instead of being ashamed about it, the easier it will be to heal the pain that surrounds addiction. And, you know, people were really moved by the film and wanting to talk to me and wanting to talk to the person sitting next to them in the theater about what their thoughts are about this and how can we come together as a community, because addiction shatters families and communities. However, if we talk about the solution and recovery, we can restore those families.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks so much for joining us. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have yourself a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
For too long, Somalis have suffered an unceasing campaign of terrorist violence. Since the beginning of the year, terrorists have perpetrated over 40 attacks of terrorism using armed suicide assaults, truck bombs, and remotely detonated improvised explosive devices in Mogadishu alone. And then, in mid-October, the most devastating attack in Somali history took place. On October 14th, the streets of Mogadishu's Hodan district were jam-packed with traffic and bystanders when a truck loaded with explosives detonated, killing at least 400 people and wounding hundreds of others. Shortly thereafter, a second, smaller explosion, believed to have been part of a coordinated plot with the first attack, took place across town. "The attack was our 9/11, said General Bashir Abdi Mohammed, the deputy commissioner of the Somali police force. No Somali was untouched. The Somali public, outraged by the brazen attack on innocent civilians, have voiced their demand for peace and justice in their country. One element working to turn the tide in Somalia's fight against terrorism is its joint investigative teams, elite Somali police force units that investigate terrorist attacks and gather evidence to identify the perpetrators and prosecute them. Set up with the help of the U.S. Department of State in 2014, they have responded to over 250 major incidents, systematically collecting and analyzing evidence that has been used to identify terrorist perpetrators, their networks, and bring them to justice. Through their hard work and dedication, the joint investigative teams are changing the public's perception of the police. The joint investigative teams are poised to take on one of Somalia's most pressing problems, that is, effectively preventing terrorist attacks. This means that the next step, said Deputy Police Commissioner Mohammed, is to become increasingly proactive, with a police force that is capable of detecting and disrupting plots before they are executed. The United States is proud to have had a hand in the formation of these police units, and we will continue to support their efforts to further build critical counterterrorism capabilities. We stand with the people and the government of Somalia in their commitment to defeating terrorism, ensuring the security of their people, and rebuilding their country. We look forward to continuing our cooperation on these and other issues.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.